Hey friends, welcome to the Rhythms for Life podcast, where each week we talk about four rhythms that help you reduce stress and anxiety and take charge of your emotional health. Rest, restore, connect, create.
These ideas come from Rebecca's best-selling book, Rhythms of Renewal, Trading Stress and Anxiety for a Life of Peace and Purpose. So grab your copy, invite your friends, and let's live in rhythm.
Welcome back to 21.
2021, it's here. I don't know for you guys, did you feel like something changed when the calendar?
Of course they did.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, you have to subconsciously.
But everybody's feel been
something.
Looking so much forward to this moment.
Well, yeah.
But has anything really changed?
Yes.
Well,
mentally,
I don't know.
For me, I'm just so over last year and excited about this year. We're already 5-6 days in. I feel like just rocking and rolling.
Well, that's because you're practicing your rhythms in the new year.
Yeah.
See, we don't do New Year's resolutions anymore. We're doing New Year's rhythms, and we hope all of you are committed to...
We're not hating on you if you do resolutions.
It's
Gave
fine.
You a very
It'll
adamant that you said that.
Well, it gets people started, but if they don't have the rhythm, we know only 20% of people fulfill those resolutions. So if you've got that goal, think about the rhythms that are going to help you reach it, because those are going to be... How
yes.
you can hit your goals.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's no shame here in resolutions. Just saying that loud, loud and proud.
Just lack of effectiveness.
Gabe, stop.
But that's okay. For
stop.
20%.
No.
One out of five people, it's going to work.
They're eye-rolling right now because they really are trying. They're only in week one. So stop.
No, they're eye-rolling you because I'm being honest.
Okay.
And they
Anyways,
appreciate that.
Okay. We're going to have a little more quarreling in 21. It'll be fine. But really, truly, if you're just taking the things that bring life and you're doing a little bit of that every single day, you're just going to come out better. And here's what I know. Here's my mantra for 21. I'm not doing another year of fear. I'm just not doing it. So no more years, not another year of fear. And I would say fear didn't drive last year, but I do think it was like, it's like that back burner, annoying thing that's trying to like get in your head. And I just don't want to entertain it. I'm just squashing it like a bug.
And we've also been encouraged this week hearing from so many of you that are starting using your Rhythms for Life planner and journal in the new year and really getting these rhythms into your daily rhythm, which is essential. If you didn't get that for Christmas and you were hoping for it, you can still get that at RebeccaLyons.com.
And they can get a discount new year. If you enter new year, you get 15% off and you can still jump in first 3 months of the year, first quarter, 90 days to peace and purpose.
Okay, so we decided to kick off the new year with this first episode. We want to talk about money because we know
money
has been, it becomes that source for so many different fights in marriages, conversations with kids, and we all have a different take on money. And we wanted to help you go a little deeper into the rhythms you've established around how you think about your money and how to invest it, how to give it, how to spend it. We want you to understand a little more of the history of where that comes from.
Yeah, your money classroom is the classroom you grew up in your home. And Rachel Cruz is in the house with us, and she's going to teach you all the things. So let's listen in now. Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
I know. We love having you. And we're neighbors. You know, we're all here in Franklin, Tennessee. So you and your family, your father, Dave, has had an influence on so many people. But what's been fun is just watching your voice continue to grow as you really bring a lot of these ideas about money. How do we think about this to a new generation whose parents maybe didn't quite train them up on some of this?
Yeah, for sure. There's like, I laugh all the time because I'm like, dad's kind of like everyone's uncle who just like tells them like it is. And I'm like, I'm your friend. Like I'll say that budgeting's hard and like walk with you through like the practical sides of money. But yeah, it's been fun to kind of figure out my voice in it all for sure.
Yeah. I think a lot of people do need their hand held, especially when they didn't grow up in your home. They didn't have the upbringing that you had, or maybe those principles laid down. I'm very curious about the relationship that we have with money. I hadn't really thought about this until lately. I would say the last few years, I had a friend come visit and she's like, is there a reason that you know the cost of every kind of milk at at Kroger. And I was like, I can't not. My mom cut double coupons every Tuesday. We had four children. They were Christian school teachers. We only got to go there because we were scholarshiped because they taught there. So I was always like the poor kid in a more kind of middle class environment. And so it was always about resourcefulness. Like, how do we stretch this dollar? But now I see that it still affects me no matter where we are in life, in, you know, 30 years later. Talk a little bit about that, I think, for our generation of what did our upbringing do to us for better or for worse?
Yeah, I mean, I think our upbringings obviously play a huge part in our lives. And as I was writing the manuscript to the new book, I interviewed so many psychologists and counselors because I was like, I want to get to the bottom of like that nature versus nurture. How much of how we handle money is just personality and tendencies? How much of it is because of our upbringing? And a lot of them, it was interesting, were like, oh, 50-50 or 49-51. And then a few of them were like, oh, no, majority of it is your upbringing. Like, your nurture shaped so much of who you are. And it was so fascinating because the more I dug into that, the more I realized, wow, it really does. Like, the strengths and weaknesses of our parents and how they handled money, it does shape who we are today. And I was figuring out, you know, money's really communicated in two ways in a household, verbally and emotionally. And it's either verbally open or verbally closed, emotionally stressed or emotionally calm. And yeah, as I was doing the manuscript, this like picture came in my head and I was like, oh my gosh, it's a graph. Like, it's a quadrant of like these two things intersecting. And I was like, Jesus, thank you for giving me a graph. Like, I love graphs. And I'm like, yeah, this is perfect. So it created really these four money classrooms. And we can walk through those in a little bit. But really, when you kind of pinpoint, okay, that is my money classroom, there's weaknesses and strengths with each one. And I find that people either mirror a lot of what their parents did, just kind of out of subconsciousness, and they just do it, or they go the complete opposite. And they're like, you know what? If I grew up with a saver mom, I have a problem with spending because I now feel like I was so controlled in that area and now I just want to spend. Or some people say, no, I saw the gifts of that, so I'm going to emulate that. So it's fascinating to watch how people take the good and bad of their money classroom.
Yeah. And we're talking about this in the context of rhythms. We talk about rhythms all the time here, and people living in a rhythm that creates flourishing, creates abundance in their mental health, emotional health, physical health. And money plays a role in that in a way that I think few people calculate it into the equation as much. They're feeling stressed. They don't realize how much it's maybe how they're thinking about money, how they use their money, how they see money, their relationship with it. So I would love for you to break down, because it's really helpful, these classrooms that kind of take us into like these few different ways in which all of us tend to approach money. So would you describe those for us?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so that first money classroom is the anxious money classroom, and that's where it's verbally closed and emotionally stressed. So if you grew up in this classroom, there was always just tension around money toward the end of the month. When bills were due, you felt it. You couldn't really pinpoint why as a kid, but it was just like, oh, you felt the anxiety, you felt the tension. Classroom two is the unstable money classroom, and that's where it's verbally open but emotionally stressed. So lots of open conflict. Probably heard your parents have the same money fight over and over and over again. Probably fought with extended family about money and you heard it. You know, I mean, it was just like lots of conflict that's out there. And then the unaware money classroom is classroom three, and that's where it's emotionally calm but verbally closed. So this classroom, maybe your head was in the sand with money. You didn't really even think about it because it wasn't talked about. There was not a lot of emotion around it. And that this classroom's interesting because the more people I interviewed that lived in this classroom found kind of resentment towards their parents, because now as they're adults, they're looking at their parents' situation and they kind of feel lied to, because a lot of their parents are not in a good financial spot, like don't have retirement, don't have savings. And they're like, Mom and Dad, like I thought everything was fine. And now you're struggling in your 70s with money. Like, I had no clue until now. So all these have different dynamics. Now, the fourth money classroom is probably the healthiest. And that is where it's verbally open and emotionally calm. So you don't have to have a lot of money to live in this classroom. You could have $10 or $10 million, but it's just that the money is, it's controlled. There's a plan. There's agreements within the family. And it's talked about. Like, it's not a taboo subject.
You're bringing order to chaos.
That's right. Exactly.
I'm guessing you grew up in a secure classroom.
Well, it's funny you ask. So when I was writing this part of the book, I had finished kind of fleshing out that. And I wrote that I was like, yeah, I mean, I did. Like, that's how I felt. And we weren't perfect with money by any means, but that it was how I felt. So I told Mom and Dad one night at dinner, I was like, yeah, I'm finishing this secure money classroom. And I feel like that's where I was. And they literally looked at each other and started laughing. And I was like, what? And they were like, because your memories start when you were like five. They're like, when we filed bankruptcy the year we were born, dad was like, oh, we were the unstable classroom for many years. Lots of fighting because we're, I mean, the Ramses are verbal, as you could probably imagine. And so, yeah, we would shift into the unstable, probably down to that secure. But I would say most of my memories are more of that secure classroom.
Right. But it just goes to show it's not about the bankruptcy. It's about what you do with it.
That's right.
Right. And I think that's why your message, your whole family's message is so powerful because it doesn't end with bankruptcy. And so many people think, well, if I couldn't manage money well then, how am I going to do that differently next time? And yet it was those practical, actionable steps that just decided, no, I'm not going to live that way because you have no agency. You have no decision-making power. That stress and anxiety is only going to ramp when you don't have a plan.
Yeah, it
and
is.
You don't, and you have a fear that you'll just kind of fall right back in the same pit that you were before. I love how we were talking before we came on air and you talked about how you're not creative. And I just want to go ahead and debunk that right now because you created graphs.
I did create graphs.
And sliding scales. And you created classrooms. So yes, you're very strong in the create rhythm. You gave language to something and gave definition that a lot of people, this is going to make sense for people. And that's really helpful for me. I did exactly what I was not one who rebelled. That would be some of my siblings. But I was one, I rebelled in other ways, but not in money. let's just be clear. But in money, I was, my mom, you know, in her upbringing, she didn't grow up with a dad present and they didn't have a lot. So she started working when she's like 9, 10, like helping be a seamstress. She was very, very resourceful, very responsible, just took responsibility. That was a high, high value, hard work, responsibility. And so she was a firstborn. I am a firstborn of three girls. I have an older brother who's adopted, but I definitely have her personality and fortitude and kind of resilience like she did. And so when I went off to college, there was not enough money for years 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to just have to get two jobs. I'm going to wait tables, Applebee's. Don't recommend it, especially all-you-can-eat rib nights.
I was going to guess Chili's. But Applebee's is
there was not a lot of pickings for waiting a wait opportunity.
But when we were dating, I would get free fries at like 11 p.m. when I would show up to pick you up.
Yeah, basically at closing if I could put you to work. Yeah. But there was something about the freedom that came with going, okay, I have a decision. I can move back home and go to a community college, or I can decide, no, I'm just going to double down with a work ethic because I understand what that looks like. I know the value of a dollar. I understand hard work, and between working on campus and off campus, I was able to get through college on my own.
It's amazing.
And that just taught me something. Now, the thing is I can sometimes take pride in that and kind of get like really kind of arrogant about that. And God's like, wait a minute, that was actually my provision that you then stewarded.
That's right, that's right.
So it's been a good, healthy thing. But sometimes I found like later in life when we would start to make money, actually get money and have a little margin, it was less about survival. It was more about stewardship. I started to be tight with it as if I'd never had it or as if it was going to go somewhere. And I know this is now free counseling for Rebecca, but I'm just wondering what it is when people finally get money and they're afraid it's going to go.
Oh, yeah.
They're very, very frugal, even if they don't have to be.
Extremely common. I actually write a few stories about that mindset in the book. And we find that a lot at Ramsey because we tell people, you know, you sacrifice. You do this stuff to get out of debt. You know, you live on nothing and everything goes toward that. And you save up that emergency fund. And then finally, when they're on the other side, they're like so scared to death to take a trip, or they're so scared to death to spend any money because they're so used to holding on to it. And so that is a total normal mindset. And so what I've realized is money's like a magnifying glass. It makes you more of what you already are. And so you can do that on the character side of your heart, and you can do that on the tactical side. So if tactically you're like, yeah, I'm good at kind of holding tight and being really wise with what I have. And if you get more money, that's what's going to be magnified. It kind of ends up. So you have to practice living with that open hand, which is scary at times, but you want to be diligent with it. Obviously, I'm not just like, oh yeah, go blow whatever you want. But like say, no, like let's just figure out, okay, here's the amount of money that is reasonable percentage-wise within our budget. And you almost have to force that open hand because I've talked to so many people and it's interesting. The giving aspect ties into all of this. Like the more you allow yourself to open your hand and even spend, the more even the generosity part of our hearts come alive.
That's awesome. Give us some previews here of information some of our listeners may not know that are just common language, common rules in the Ramsey world. Okay. Emergency fund. How big is that supposed to be?
Yes.
How many months?
So we say starting out is $1,000. Then once you're completely out of debt, you bump that up to 3 to 6 months worth of expenses.
Okay.
And that can sit in a savings account, a money market account. Just don't invest it because the goal here is that this is like insurance. It's not an investment. And this probably kills some math people. They're like, I have 6 months worth of money sitting in just a savings account. Like, I could make more money with it. I'm like, no, it's there because it's like insurance. You need to be able to get to it quickly.
And does that play into, you talk a little bit about fear. And you talk a lot about that in this book. And we're in a season coming through a pandemic where there's a lot of fear about the future. There's not a lot of security about where income's coming from. Is my job going to be there? Am I going to have to get, you know, unemployment to have an income? You know, there's just crazy questions most people are having to think about and ask. And how does that fear start to play into our lives as we manage money?
Yeah, 2020 was such an interesting year because of it. I mean, I think it exposed a lot of our bad money habits. Warren Buffett always says, when the tide goes out, you can tell who was skinny dipping. So you're like, okay, here I am. Like, gosh, everything, golly, like, you know, the things I was doing, I could cover up with making more money. And then when you can't make more money and everything stops, everything's exposed. So in that moment, fear is a terrible financial advisor. And a lot of people were leaning on fear and anxiety alone to make financial decisions. And that is a bad road. They're pulling money out of the market. They're cashing out their 401k. I mean, they were doing things out of panic and for good reason, right? It was a scary time. I mean, I remember even March, April, beginning of May, even Winston and I had discussions where I was like, what is going to happen? Like, I mean, we've done the plan for 10 years. So like on paper, we're fine, but I still felt this anxiety of like, but what if, like, what if the whole world crashes down? Like, what's going to happen? And so what you have to realize, is not leaning on that fear, but using that fear as a gift. And I interviewed Dr. Chip Dodd for this part of it, because I love what he talks about fear. And he says that he's like, fear is your body's literal reaction to needing help. Like, it's your body saying, I need help with something. And so using that. So when a money fear does bubble up, I always say, name it, figure it out. I talk about six in the book that are common that I hear all the time, but like, figure out what it is. And then what are things you can put in place that when you say, yeah, I need help now, I have this fear, what is it? And so one huge fear, the number one financial fear for women is financial insecurity. That if something were to happen, am I going to be okay? It's exactly what I asked Winston as we were sitting in bed in May. I was like, oh my gosh, we're going to be okay. And that's a real fear. So what do? Well, you can put things in place tactically, like the emergency fund we just talked about. Get out of debt. Like, if you have no debt, you have no bills, and you have, you know, money in the bank, you're in a totally different position than if you were living paycheck to paycheck and had no savings. 40% of Americans couldn't cover a $400 emergency in cash. And so there's a lot of that will drive you. So let that fear be a gift to say, you know what, I'm going to put principles in place in my life. I'm going to change the way I've been handling my money so that there is these safeguards. And that's wisdom. I mean, all that's from scripture. I mean, God talks about that. And so doing that is wise. So using that fear, whatever that fear is, as a gift. And again, it can go tactical, but it also can go emotional. And you guys talk about, you know, when it gets unhealthy and goes to anxiety, all of that. That is very unhealthy. We don't want to go there. But there's a level of our hearts too that people lean on money so much as their security. To that extreme, it can get unhealthy as well. So there's heart issues too in this fear that you have to address.
Yeah, that's so good. I think people do find themselves still, even in this year, kicking it off at a crossroads. There's still some fog. There's still some residual hangover from a 2020 moment that just changed the trajectory for so many people. A lot of people did get resourceful and they tried new things, and that word pivot, if I never hear it again, that's fine.
I always think of Ross on Friends when you're like moving that couch and you're like, pivot. Yeah.
Thank you for that. Now I want to go watch that episode again. But it's true. I think it did kind of show us our true colors of like, did we kind of put our head in the sand, or were kind of like, were we desperate to go, oh, then we're scrambling, but we're going to do something. You know, I think there was a lot of failing forward, but in a good way. I think it got a lot of us out of our comfort zone of what became normative. Maybe we'd lost even a little bit of passion to go, how do we dream again? How do we begin again? What everyone has had to do. It doesn't matter what you do. There's not a single person that hasn't had to think differently about their vocation as a result of this global pandemic. So I would say for those listening today, I would ask, they're still taking risks right now financially. They're still trying to set themselves up. Maybe, like you said, like if you weren't prepared, they're now catching up. They're still trying to kind of get their house back in order. What is some of your counsel? I mean, this book is going to be such a good resource for people. I cannot wait for everyone to get this in their hands. But as they walk this out, what would be kind of that counsel initially to go, how would they know that fear is driving the train and how to rein that back in, and or when to just enact courage to just risk a little bit too?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah, I think some people just became paralyzed and stayed paralyzed with everything. They just kind of froze up and did nothing. And while there were some industries that were, I mean, still completely gone, I mean, they're just hospitality, hotel, airline, cruise, I mean, like all of that, right? Like it's now on the cusp, sort of coming back, but not really. But there were other industries that absolutely boomed. And so if you were obviously in an industry where you lost your job, you were furloughed, or your company, or you owned a company and it was like not in a good position, then yeah, pausing for a moment is really wise to say, you know what, I'm going to just gather cash flow. I'm going to do things that are smart, and I'm not going to take these risks right this second because it's not wise for me, because maybe you don't have that income coming in. And that's okay. Be patient, take your time. And then, yeah, if you have to pivot, change what you're doing, do that. But then other people didn't lose their job. While there were tens of millions that did, there's tens of millions that didn't. And people were in industries that they still are working and they're still going to their jobs. They weren't furloughed and they're still frozen in fear. And so I would say you have to move forward with facts. And so this is where you kind of have to lean on, okay, am I in an industry? Am I in a job? Am I in a company that we really are okay? I'm probably not going to be laid off. Like, I'm probably am going to continue to work. Well, if that's the case, then you have to move forward. You cannot stay paralyzed in that fear because it's unwise at that point. And so moving forward, whether it's in your own personal finances, whether it's within business and taking risks there. And so that's my thing, is like fear, it can get so emotional, where leaning on facts is really important in those times. When you do feel paralyzed, look at the facts. And the fact may be, yeah, my industry is down and I'm still not back to work. Okay, then pause. That's okay. Be patient and pause and figure out what you can do there. But if you're continuing to be okay, quote unquote, continue to be okay. Like, keep stepping forward. Have faith that, like, yeah, God's gonna provide. It's okay. You're still moving forward. But that's based on facts, not emotion.
Samaritan Ministries is a community of Christians who live out Galatians 6:2 by bearing one another's burdens when a medical need arises. And I want to encourage each of you to check this out in this new year. As you're looking at your budget, as you're trying to evaluate where can you cut costs, where could there be a savings, I know when we talk about medical needs, that can create a lot of nervousness. But Samaritan's Ministries has created such a way to do this. It's so unique, and it actually saves you so much money. It's not traditional insurance, but you do have the freedom to choose the doctor, hospital, and pharmacy that works best for you and your family. And then Samaritan members directly share those medical expenses with one another. It's affordable. You can join today, go talk to them, figure out what would this cost for your family, and consider if you're in a transition or you're looking at that budget, I think you'll be impressed with what they can provide. So you can learn more at SamaritanMinistries.org/RFL podcast. That's SamaritanMinistries.org/RFL podcast. We talk a lot about New Year's rhythms instead of just New Year's resolutions, which we know so few people really follow through on those. And yet rhythms are something we can carry throughout the year. And part of what you're talking about is a rhythm of how we think about dreaming again, saving money. Some New Year's resolutions or goals are dreams. And yet those require sacrifice. They require saving. And with so few people even having enough to cover an emergency, how many more don't even have the ability to save or work towards a dream? Talk about that, the power of a dream in helping drive the way we start to think about sacrifice and money.
Toward the end of the book, I was like, okay, I want to figure out, why do we give the way we give? Why do we spend the way we spend? And why do we save the way we save? And so much of that saving, as I dove into that, I'm like, so much of our saving, besides the emergency fund, like the tactical side, but beyond that, it really is attached to what we want our lives to look like where we feel like God is calling us, the goals we have in life, which is our dreams. And it's so hard, and it might just be my season of life, but Winston and I talk all the time. We're like, man, I have not looked up past this 24-hour block of time or this week on the calendar in a long time. Like, we'll go months where we're just like head down. You wake up, you do breakfast, get the kids ready, get them out the door. You're at work, figuring out dinner, picking up dinner, making dinner when they get home, baths, homework, bedtime. And you're doing it all again. Like, it's so easy to get in that rut. And Winston and I have made it a priority in our lives that we just do our, we call it a dream date night. It's kind of cheesy, but we'll go out to dinner and we'll just say, okay, let's say money's off the table. Like, what do we want to do in 5 years? Like, what do we want our family to look like? What experiences do we want to have with them? What things do we want to do with generosity? Like, let's just dream. And the moment you start to dream, the moment you allow your minds to go there, and then within that, you can kind of whittle down and say, okay, here are things that keep rising up to the surface that we talked about. So, okay, let's put some action to these dreams. And not all dreams have to have a financial tail to it, But a lot of them do. A lot of them do require some kind of funding or anything. And so when you have that dream, for me as a spender, it's so much easier and more exciting to save. So I always say savings follows your dreams. And if you don't have a dream, that's the first problem, right? So figure it out and have those goals and be looking not just past this week, like look in the future and enjoy that. And then say, okay, now I can put money away for these things. And it's so much more enjoyable and fun than just, for me, than just like this like black hole of like, let's just put money in a bank and build bigger barns, if you will, and we don't know what we're gonna do with it. I'm like, no, it needs purpose. There's something there. And we all have purpose in our lives. And so figuring that out, what God's calling you and your family to, oh, it makes it that much more exciting.
Yeah, C.S. Lewis had this quote where he said, imagination precedes fact. Mm. And if we don't have the imagination to dream and, you know, asking God to shape those dreams, to give us vision for a future that, like you said, it could be about generosity. It could be about how we're to partner with him more and what he's trying to do in the world. I think he wants to deliver those dreams. Like there's a lot of assignments in the world that go unmet that God wants us to do because we don't have the courage to just ask or invite him into that.
Yeah, vision precedes provision. And I think sometimes we're like looking for the resources and the funding for something, but there's not a vision. There's not a vision that you're actually propelling. I was thinking about our kids. You know, we have two very different personalities with money in two of our kids. But our daughter, she has a vision now. Like she's usually like instant gratification, like where's the dollar store?
Yeah.
When she was like 8, 9, and 10, she'd get like $5 and it was burning a hole in her
pocket.
That
was me.
Whereas Pierce knew that if you put that $5 in the bank, we would double it immediately and he could get it when he was 16. She's like, no way. I can't even imagine waiting until I'm 16. Well, she came to us last night. She's like, I need to make $3,000 in the next 6 months because she knows her window's closing of where we'll double her money. Like we'll only do that till she's 16. And it's like she wakened to it at 15 and going, I actually want to drive a car at some point in my life. That's mine. And so she is determined. She's like, last night made the plan, like how many hours, because she's now working a job at Chick-fil-A, so she's super excited. But how many hours will I need to work per week? How many weeks? Like, I'm like, okay, good. It's stuck. There's still time.
It's still there.
You know, and that's just a reminder of no matter what your personality is, maybe you kind of like those small things, but you don't really have anything to show for it after a season. It's never too late. Vision will actually bring that out of you. That's bigger than that, like, nail polish for a dollar, you know, on the counter. And that, I think, is the reminder for a lot of us who kind of can't see it. Like, create a vision that's approachable, right? Not something so crazy that you're like, well, where would I begin? But maybe make a 6-month dream or a 1-year dream or a 3, then 5. Like as you keep going and growing in what those things require, it's still good to test the waters if you're not typically one who wants to save towards something and have that long game.
If you're married, you have some good advice in this book about, you know, better understanding how your spouse may process what they want to spend money on. You talk about experiences or things. Can you describe a little bit about some of these just differences that aren't necessarily moral differences? Like, hey, if you want the vacation, that's immoral. We need to buy a house, you know?
That's right. That's right.
How would you describe some of those tendencies that different people have that are all okay, but we need to understand them?
Yeah. So there's 7 of them I write about in the book. And like you said, there's no moral compass. There's not a good or bad. But the extremes of each of these can get unhealthy, if you will. So like, we all lean one way or the other. So like spender versus saver. I'm a spender. Winston's the saver. We're opposite and everything. What are y'all, spender saver?
For sure, saver.
I'm a spend saver.
She's
we both don't
like,
spend
no.
a lot. Come on.
Well, I've worked it out of him.
Your natural bents. Yeah,
she beat it out of me.
So when you buy things, you enjoy buying experiences or an actual item, like a thing.
I prefer experiences.
I prefer things.
There you go.
That's Winston and I. I'm experience. Yeah, he's things.
But you love golf, and that's an experience.
But I don't do it as much because we're saving. For a thing.
I know. I laugh because Winston and I, we got married really young, right out of college. And like the first probably year of our marriage, whenever we went out to eat to Chili's or Applebee's, you know, one of the great chains of this world, I was always like, let's just get like a glass of wine or just like, I don't know, like let's just have the appetizer and the dessert. And he was like, no. no, no, no. Like, he's like, I'm just good with water. I'm good with water. Like, literally, we laugh. I'm like, he drank water at restaurants like the first year and a half we were married. Gets to him, he's like, no, what that costs, I could buy something so much better, for, even for that $10. He's like, no. And after a while, now, as I was writing the book, I was like, man, if I had that verbiage where I'm like, he just doesn't value experiences. Like, he would rather have, like, he's asking for, like, Alexa light bulbs for Christmas that, like, he can be like, Alexa, turn living room on. And they come on. He's like, oh, yeah, that's what I'll spend money on all day long.
That's
like,
hilarious.
That kind of thing where I'm like, no, a vacation, or I'll go to the zoo with the kids. Like, I do. I love a good experience.
I love a good experience. But I have to say that when we first started dating, I was the first girlfriend of Gabe that ever got him to split a meal with her.
So ridiculous. I mean, to this day, every time we're at a restaurant, still to this day, it's like, what are you ordering? I'm like, well, what do you mean?
Two side salads and split the entree.
I'm going to get my like, own
entree. You're
getting
the most expensive thing on the menu. Why?
That's good. Do you read the menu from like left to right or right to left? Yeah, that's another good one. That should have been a tendency. That's a good one. Yeah.
Well, Rachel, we just love how you're helping make these ideas around money just more palatable to people and practical, and in connection with our friends and our spouses. It's so critical that we can talk about these things. I know money does create some of the most dramatic conflicts. I know divorce comes from a lot of money conflict. And so if we're going to be connected to our spouse, if we're going to be in healthy relationships, we've got to know how to talk about these things. And you do it so well, and it's so helpful to so many. So thank you for being a part of this today.
Yeah, thank you guys. Thanks for having me. I know it was funny. I was trying to fit the word relationship within the subtitle of the book because I'm like, it brings so much empathy when you start to really see other people. You know, it didn't fit, which is totally fine. But yeah, hopefully it's a good guide for people, just for language, even if that's what they need.
Yeah, you definitely are a friend to the person walking through this. So thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Isn't she awesome?
Yeah, she's so fun to talk to, and she breaks it down. She's different than her dad, Dave.
Most people are used to Dave. Yeah.
But I like her approach.
I do too.
I think our kids could listen to that. And, you know, it'd be a helpful thing. So hopefully you're listening to this, maybe in the car. Turn it on. Let your kids hear this. It's a great way to start the year thinking about goals financially, how you're going to get there, how you're going to spend and invest money this year. I think it's very practical.
Yes, it is. Know yourself, know your money, discover why you handle money the way you do and what to do about it. So grab the book. Start your year right. Get smart with your money. January is a great month to set up intention for 2021.